Well, I grew up in Mayfield, which is this side of the Sussex border. But all my life, I've lived in Brighton. So from the age of a few months old, I've always lived in Brighton. I wasn't a particularly studious type. I used to help the milkman quite often for a few coppers. And I don't know that I was terribly naughty in that sort of world, but I really enjoyed my childhood. I think things were very hard in those days, but on the other hand, you made the most of everything you got. It was as simple as that, really.
And you were a teenager then when war broke out. What did that period mean to you when the news first came through that Britain had gone to war?
Well, I was actually down in Westry in Brighton, and the siren sounded, as you probably know, and we all took cover, etc. We all felt that the roof was going to fall in on us any time. We lived in a sort of a limbo world, if you know what I mean. You know, Dunkirk had actually happened. We're all at sixes and sevens. And I think, like many young people, I decided to join the army underage, which many did. So I went to the recruiting office, walked out of my job as it happened, and the sergeant, etc., etc., didn't query my age at all, not in any way. And a little amusing situation, which I think typifies the kind of mothers that were there, you know. I got home, I'd lost my father a few years earlier, and she said to me, I said to her, I've joined the army. So she said, oh yes, she said, when do you go? I said, in about 2 or 3 weeks' time. And she looked at me and she said, whatever you do, make sure, let me know, and I'll make you some sandwiches. You know, and that kind of thing. I've always treasured that kind of memory because many years afterwards, I felt that it probably cost her the whole month's cheese ration.
It's interesting you talk about the attitude to war then. Do you think attitudes then were different to war than perhaps they are now?
Well, it would depend. I mean, we finish up in these sort of areas of conflict, should I say, which quite often are a little bit, we wonder what we're doing there, that kind of thing. Now, faced with a situation, as we had in 1940 and thereon, I would hesitate to sort of just say, no, they just wouldn't. It is true to say, of course, that things have changed a lot. There's certainly a lot. But faced with a common enemy, then I think, yes, why not? Why not?
In that period, you were part of the Special Volunteer Force. What did that actually mean?
You joined the parachute regiment, and everyone there wants to be there. That's the whole thing about that kind of regiment. The people that want to be there have strived, gone through the physical, etc., etc., and they want to be there. And I think that is what makes a first-class fighting unit.
And, I mean, we'll touch upon this as we continue, but I'm sure the camaraderie that you had there was immeasurable.
Oh, it was, really. It's very difficult to describe, really, unless you've been among it, as it were. Many, many friends, of course, have gone now, but we still have a reunion dinner every year, and the old camaraderie is still there.
Talk me through the training for the D-Day operation. That was obviously quite intense.
Yes, it was. What actually happened was this. Although we were part of a parachuting unit, we were asked to provide volunteers to crash land inside the battery. And the idea was, we went to Inkpen Ranges. The replica battery was built by the airborne engineers, and we rehearsed it day and night until we knew where situations were in terms of machine gun emplacements, flak towers, etc., etc. So that was the training.
When you're in that position, do you have total confidence in what you're being told? Is there any point where you question the plan? Because obviously a huge plan, and obviously so much rested on it.
Well, yes, it was a huge plan, certainly. But, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it all centres around one thing. It's belief. Now, if you believe in your leadership, in your training, in your camaraderie around you, and above all, believe in yourself.
But there must have been times where you were frightened or at least fearful of what was going to happen.
I suppose many of you have never been in action for the first time, of course. They're apprehensive, not fearful. Mainly, how will I react under fire? Will I not let the regiment or my comrades down? That kind of thing.
Because actually, you'd never heard a shot fired.
No, never heard a shot fired. And of course, you have to understand here, and I think it's important, we left the relative quiet countryside to fly over to France, made of a couple of hours or so, and then we were engaged in a firefight with German forces.
And what were your thoughts on that flight over? What was going through your mind?
Strange you should say that, because I've gone over and over it, and this may sound strange. I sat in the glider, and we'd already had some glider training, and I could see the snakes of the tow rope coming out. And when those engines revved up and the plane started to move down the runway, I could visualise all that was happening. And then you get the rush along the runway and then the lift into the air. And it was then that I thought, this is for real. That's when it didn't strike me on going into the land or anything like that. I thought it's almost like you've been playing soldiers, but this is for real.
And almost right from the word go, actually, things didn't go to plan.
They went not according to plan at all. The first glider crashed in England. The second glider, the parachute arrestor gear, was damaged. We got over the battery. The glider cast off, and we're point of no return. We start to glide down. There's no action from the ground forces. So it's fire, an illuminated flare up, nothing at all. The glider pilot had to make a decision, and he lifted us over the minefield, and we crashed into an orchard, possibly 200 metres or so away. Fate then intervened on our behalf, because we ran smack into a group of Germans that were coming up to reinforce the battery. And we engaged them. And that was the thing that our training took over, because not only I'd been hit in the legs anyway, tumbled out, but immediately we got into the firing position, returned the fire, and they broke off the engagement after a time. So we, in effect, although we hadn't actually achieved the objective, we played what I think was a major role in the exercise.
But of course, you lost comrades, and as you've already mentioned, you yourself suffered injuries as well.
Yes, that's right. I was wounded in both legs. After that, I tried to follow the battalion to the next objective. I just couldn't keep up. Legs were full of blood, etc. Then the next glider, they had dropped a couple of miles away. They found me, and they left me in a field with two wounded Germans, one of which I gave morphine because he was hit in the stomach and I could only moisten his lips. I expected to be picked up by British troops, naively, not by German troops, anyway. But with hindsight, perhaps it possibly saved my life, because when I was put in the bag, as they say...
Just describe what you've just shown to me.
Well, that is a Fairburn Sykes fighting knife. It's not... doesn't conform to the rules of war, to the convention. And we wore these down there.
Down the side of your leg, effectively, yeah.
That's it, yeah. The idea being, in a close quarter contest, it was ready to pull out, not from up in a belt, down here, yeah, and upwards, like that. Was one of the things that the Germans found on me, and they didn't like it. The steam gun I had, I'd smashed up, scattered the four winds. Things turned ugly when they saw this. And another thing I had, which was a phosphorus grenade, in which I'd put 9mm rounds into it to make it more effective in explosion. And then, fortunately, the younger German pointed to his comrade and obviously said something. And the whole atmosphere changed. Shook hands. Took that, of course. And I was taken to a field hospital. And then on to a place called Evreux. And then a place called Pont-l'Evêque.
And the mood changed because, presumably, because you had helped the German earlier on with the morphine.
That's right, yes. There's one thing that bothered me, of course, and that was I hadn't got a watch. And the thing that bothered me was I knew that somehow I had to try to keep calculating the time to make sure that when he was picked up, wherever it might be, they knew that the time, you know, that he could have another injection, for instance.
So you found yourself eventually at the hospital in Paris?
That's right, in the Hôpital de la Pitié. Whilst in there, I was rather fortunate. Well, I was absolutely outraged at being taken prisoner. It became an obsession with me to get back to my unit. And everything I did from that point on was planned in that respect. But of course, the real gem, really, was being in Paris. Because if you can't escape there, then you're never going to get it. So I was fortunate enough. I made myself friendly with a nursing sister on the ward. I hobbled around, made myself look worse than it was. But the main thing of that was it enabled me to move out of the ward. And so me being out of the ward, no one bothered particularly. And I had other tasks to do which weren't, which they were glad to let me get on with. That was in the dying room where they had men that were dying from their wounds, etc., amputated limbs, you know, bedpans, that sort of thing. But whoever, it was all part of my little plan. The Free French Division were coming into Paris. The Germans got rather lax in their security. But on the other hand, they recognising the fact that the Free French were coming in, they started to ship people out. So time wasn't on my side. So I spoke with them, Mark, and I believe it was Pascal. Now, I don't think they were active members of the resistance, but they knew people. And the idea was they would have a little demonstration up at the main gate. I would make my way down to the bottom, the incinerator, get through a casement window. Well, at the first they said the door would be open, but it actually wasn't. Then I'd a short walk, maybe a couple of metres, and then there was a little high wall and I had to jump down there. That was the idea. Mark, he left a convenient coat for me to put on, and I walked down the stairs. He said, "I'll go down in front of you with a bundle of washing, etc." I said, "So just keep going on. If they stop me, you know nothing." So get down to the basement. Door's not unlocked. Mark's down there with me, helps me up onto a worktop, out to a casement window, 2 metres or so, and then I sort of underestimated this jump. And I crashed down, and of course wounds opened up. People from the resistance were there to carry me away. Went to a farmhouse, which, as I recall, was like in a mews, and I stayed there for a time in that place. I met up Terry Jepp, who was a friend of mine. He had escaped sometime as well. Free French division coming down the road, and all of a sudden, shots are fired from up here. So everybody sort of looks around, and I'm armed, actually. And we went into this building, climbed up the stairs until we got to a narrow corridor. And coming down from the other end, there was a French lady pointing. We go down there, push the door open. I fire a couple of shots. There's a curtain hanging across the room. Got to the window, and it disintegrated around us. And the whole ceiling came down. And we got out as quick as we could. Because what had happened, apparently, we found out, that because they didn't know that we were in there, they'd pointed up to the window, and this half track started blazing away. So that was another, I suppose, air of a charmed life. The French doctor, he couldn't treat my wounds anyway, so they got an American liaison officer with the Free French Army Division, got a jeep up, took me down to the coast, and they had shuttlecock all the time. They weren't allowed off the airfield at all. So they simply went to Blandford, which was the American hospital. There again, I went to Shaftesbury Military Hospital, and then Donhead St Andrews, I think it was. Very nice time in there. One of the reasons was that the VADs, which is a voluntary aid detachment, I was rather fortunate to be pointed out as the one to have the bath things. Hmm. And I say, well, most excited, joyful experience in the British Army.
When did you eventually return to the UK?
I got to my Bulford about late October. The regiment had come back from Normandy then, and then I joined them at that time. Pretty bad to see some old friends lost, of course. I joined them, and then we went, of course, to the Ardennes, and then on the Rhine crossing. That was it. And then we met up with the Russians at Wismar, up on the Baltic coast.
And It's fascinating talking to you today because you're talking as though it was yesterday. Does it feel like 70 years ago?
No, not to me. I can remember every detail. I mean, I don't regard myself as a hero. I just did what many other people felt was right and proper to do. And I am grateful that people still remember. And the reason I say that is not because I'm glorifying war. It is just to remember what can happen if these unscrupulous people get their hands into power. As simple as that.
And in terms of how you personally remember, you go regularly back to France every year.
Yes, that's right. The reception we receive is out of this world. It really is. We've many friends there now. I mean, you've got to realise that we have seen generations growing up here. And it says it all, really. You know, we've seen the little ones and then they get bigger, you know, and so on. And the first time we went over, it's still in the school now, we took over a very, very, very nice rocking horse for the children. And this is what I say to myself when I see these children running about, when I'm used to have on their back, a child of freedom. And that really says it all, because you can either live on your feet or die on your knees.
And what will you be doing to mark the 70th anniversary?
I wish we hadn't got awash with dignitaries and these people who want photo shoots. I want to see the people that have welcomed us every year. Now, an example of that, when we were on our boat coming across, our secretary rang the mayor in Merville, Franceville Plage, and there'd been a mix-up on our bookings. We couldn't go there anymore. We pulled up outside the Marie there, and what is there? Crowds of people to take us in. These are the people, these are real people, you know, not these other people. They mean nothing to me, nothing. I've had people come up to me. There was a young woman, I remember. I was on top of one of the casements, and she came up to me and she said, "Thank you for my children."
That's wonderful, isn't it? Talk to me about life on Civvy Street, effectively, after the war. I can see pictures behind. Presumably, they may be grandchildren.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife, unfortunately, I lost her a couple of years ago. That's all it makes. Doesn't have the woman's touch. But I'm very glad that she lived to see our great-grandchildren. It's what it's all about. Family.
And are you somebody now, I mean, obviously in recent times we've had conflicts with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan. Are you somebody now who looks ahead to the future and thinks actually overall the positives will outweigh the negatives?
I think it will do, providing that people are aware that wherever you've got a dictator in power, wielding those powers, then you can have trouble. They've got to specify someone as an enemy. You've got to be very wary.
I'm taken by the picture behind you there. That presumably is you. What year would that have been taken?
That was actually 1945 in the Ardennes. I'd been blown up by something, well, I don't know whether it's mine or what it was. Anyway, I finished up in Eindhoven Hospital, and when I got out and walked around the town, I went into a photographer, and he got that. And the strange thing about that is, I always thought, see, my niece I met 56 years since I've met her, and I knew that it'd been a frame, like that sort of thing. When she gave me this, on the back of it is my mum's writing and what she wanted the colours to be on that picture.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing your memories with me today, and I know that everybody else will have enjoyed listening to them as well. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, my pleasure.